I think that my analytic awareness of denial and projection and the concreteness of psychic reality when executive function wanes, that I could help the other caretakers, David and Connie, to understand some of what was going on, because to give them a way to understand that relieved their sense of frustration and uncertainty. And indeed, I think of the analytic awareness of denial, of projection, that these things are not generally recognized by many caretakers, but that it does reorient and make the caretaking function much more tolerable and much more, it expands, I think, the understanding of what goes on in the waning personality. Now, I also think that analytic work fosters the capacity to tolerate ambiguity, uncertainty, pain, and frustration, and in that way may allow us, the analytic mind, to tolerate some of the intense affect that, more as sort of a phrase I love from some Italian analyst, as writings waiting to be completed by the analytic mind that can hold and metabolize the difficulty, so that offer that kind of function rather than unpleasantness just to be rid of. So those are some of the things that I felt are useful as a psychoanalyst.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This podcast consists of conversations with psychoanalysts from around the world who share with us their clinical and psychoanalytic work with individuals both on and off the couch. And what we mean by off the couch is that they share with us their community involvement in many different venues apart from their consultation rooms. They describe their work in hospitals, in community clinics, in refugee centers, in classrooms, indeed in war zones. We also have conversations with psychoanalysts who are focusing their work on the couch, and they are continuing to refine both our familiar and novel understandings of the dynamic mind as it presents itself in the analytic situation. Please visit our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can subscribe, where you can see the recommended readings provided by our guests, and you can also leave a comment. I hope you enjoy these conversations and find them thoughtful and meaningful. And I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Dr. Maxine Anderson. Dr. Anderson is a training and supervising analyst at the Northwestern Psychoanalytic Society and Institute, the Seattle Psychoanalytic Institute and Society, and the Canadian Psychoanalytic Society. Our conversation today is about an unusual topic for analysts to be discussing. It revolves around her new book entitled The Hardest Passage, A Psychoanalyst Accompanies Her Patient's Journey into Dementia. And she describes for us what it was like for her when a patient she had last seen 40 years ago, called her up and asked to be cared for by her again, now for her deteriorating cognitive functioning. We discuss what that moment was like for her, how it brought back so much of their past together, and perhaps to some extent relived it. She discusses and shares with us her countertransference reaction at times of herself losing her memory, how her treatment of the patient had to evolve from at times being an insight-providing caregiver to then being a witnessing and being present caregiver. And she also talks about how she had to enlarge the frame of originally treating just the patient and then with her husband and then with her caregiver. And when I asked her what it is that she is an analyst she felt in particular brought to this challenge, she answered. And when I asked her what it is she learned from this treatment that she was able to bring to the care of her other patients, one of the things she said is that it deepened her appreciation to understand loss and to mourn. I'd learned a great deal from reading the book, from our speaking, and I hope you find it as satisfying as I did. Maxine, welcome to the podcast. It's so good to have you.
Thank you, Harvey. Good to be here.
Dementia lives as a cloud over our field, and it does so in two ways, both individually and institutionally. On an individual basis, as is well known, analysts tend to be older, and age is the greatest risk factor for the development of dementia. And we all know that. We may not want to think about it all the time, and our patients may not want to think about it all the time, but we all do know that. There are other risk factors, and recent research gives us some reason to be optimistic, because there are other risk factors, specifically genetic risk factors, that one can learn about oneself. And whether one does or doesn't have those risk factors, there are various steps you can take to minimize the risk. And there are researchers who recommend, depending upon one's risk factors, various medications and or supplements that have more and less been shown to soften the trajectory, slow the development of cognitive decline. So there's reason to be hopeful for the near future. On an institutional level, dementia is a cloud and makes its presence known in two forms. One is as tragedy, and one is as calamity. The tragedy is when a clinician develops mild cognitive impairment, MCI, and becomes aware of it, either themselves or through friends and colleagues or patients, and takes the necessary steps to minimize any risk to the people they work with. That's the tragedy. The calamity is when clinicians develop mild cognitive impairment or even early dementia, and either due to psychogenic denial or due to organic deterioration of executive functioning, is unable to acknowledge their deteriorating condition. And at times, even in the face of colleagues, family, and friends, cajoling the person to step down to protect patients and supervisees, they refuse to do so. That's calamity. Institutes take various steps to try to minimize that. One thing that some institutes do is they develop a buddy system where you officially link with a colleague, hopefully one who is not a close friend, who, when you get a certain age, sort of checks in on you informally to determine to make sure that you're intact and able to do the work. And the other subject that institutes have embarked upon is taking up the question is, at what age should analysts be forbidden, loaded word, I get it, but be forbidden from taking on new analysands? And of course, it isn't the age when you start the treatment, but it's the age with how long the treatment will go that adds a real challenging variable to what to do in those circumstances. These will be topics for another time, but what's noticeable in this topic is the absence of reference to patients. Patients, too, develop dementia. And most commonly, when they do, they are referred to people with expertise in that area, neurologists, etc. But Maxine, your work introduces us to another possibility, and that is working with an analyst who helps their former analysand cope with their dementia. And it's quite a journey. As I mentioned, the name of the book is The Hardest Passage, A Psychoanalyst Accompanies Her Patient's Journey into Dementia. And I want to start us off, before I ask you to introduce us to Sally, the name you've given your former patient, From the back of the book, you sort of give an overview of how you approach it. And you write, "My experience with Sally suggests that paying close attention, which involves acknowledging, even suffering, the feelings that may be so painful to observe, helped her to feel accompanied. Being able to be present, often without words, amidst her pain, also seemed to reach beneath her fear and resonate with the perhaps dormant attachment circuits residing in implicit memory. When she could feel deeply met in this way, and thus sheltered to some extent, the agony of loss and isolation lessened. This, then, is part of what care can bring, what our turning toward, rather than away from dementia, can foster. And for the carebringer, this presence involves preserving the respect and humanity for all parties in a complex situation, while also trying to appreciate human limits of self and other." The two sentences in these paragraphs that really gripped me was this phrase, which is a theme throughout the book, and that is turning toward rather than away from dementia, because we all know how tempting it is to turn away from it. And also how quickly you bring in attention to the caregiver, because that's an essential part of the clinical scene. Maxine, tell us about Sally and your early experience with her.
Sally was one of my very first training cases, control cases, how we describe. So I saw her back in the 70s when I was in psychoanalytic training in Seattle. I saw her for several years. The work was based around neurotic issues of around the marriage and her self-esteem. And then I relocated to London, England, for 8 years of postgraduate study. So I had ended our work. She and I had not spoken over that nearly 45 years gap. But when I heard her voice on my email, this was during the COVID in 2020, I recognized who it was immediately. I would like to read a little bit of what was quite moving to me, and it's in the book, about our first video contact. I should say, she and her husband lived in a distant state, and so nearly all of our connection was via video. But we had a very regular kind of connection.
Let me just mention before you read that paragraph, I just want to underline what you said, because it's an important phenomenon when, and I've had the experience, I assume it's fairly common, that when you pick up the phone and there's a patient you haven't seen in many decades, and instantly you know who that person is. And it's a comment on the analytic process. It's a comment on our mind, our memories, and how, you know, patients often are concerned with, you know, will they live in us and with us beyond the treatment? And it's hard for them to really wrap their head around the fact that, yes, of course, but in such a deep way that instantly, just like you're about to describe, the whole picture, it's like a hologram, just pops into your head when you hear a voice from decades ago. So, yes, please read.
Thank you for bringing that, because I also felt a trove of memories was immediately opened up.
Right.
And that was remarkable to experience from my view. Okay. So, so we arranged a video call. And at first, as we're on the video, I wondered whether Sally was either unable to recognize me after all this time, or that she was feeling that I had disappeared after a brief connection. Later, thinking back, I pondered whether this momentary event where she seemed to recognize me and then to lose me on the screen, a flicker of recognition was how I thought of it. Later, thinking back, I pondered whether this momentary event might also have been a living expression of the problem she was facing, that is, fading memory leading to valued parts of herself and others becoming lost from view after a flickering presence. Her husband, David, asked her there whether she could see Maxine there on the screen. But it was not until I asked Sally whether she knew who I was that she really seemed to see me. She responded, "Oh, yes, yes, you are Maxine Anderson." We both smiled and nodded as our possibly fragile connection seemed to become sturdier. I wondered whether Sally needed to hear my voice as well as to see my image in order to bolster her sense of my presence. And I was reminded of the power of vocal recognition which I had experienced upon hearing her message on my answer machine. Her immediate question was whether I was still working and whether I would have time to see her. Now, while faced with a full schedule during the pandemic, I felt impelled personally and professionally to see her again. She had already asked me, saying that identified her problem as mild cognitive impairment. So, therefore, I felt impelled personally and professionally to see her again, and felt that offering her as regular a rhythm as possible was important, especially given the fragility of her memory and the need to try to establish a reliable link. It seemed that reliability was important, as the continuity of our meetings, bolstered by a sense of our knowing each other over decades, seemed to offer some trust and stability in the face of her currently increasing dread of, as she would put it multiply, losing parts of my mind.
Now, let me just pause at this moment, because what you're describing is a patient you haven't seen or heard from in 40 years calling you up and both telling you and demonstrating to you that she is suffering from cognitive impairment. And I think, as I mentioned before, that many of us would certainly pause and ask oneself, what can I offer this person? She has a neurologic condition, and yet she called me. She contacted me all these years later. And I guess if we were thoughtful and courageous, as you and your book demonstrates, we would have said, well, this will be a journey for both of us. And why don't we undertake it and see if it is to your benefit? And so you did.
Yeah. May I just say a word about that? That I wasn't sure, and I was
lots of words. Absolutely, right.
Okay. I wasn't sure whether I could help her, but I was moved by her returning after so many decades. And I mentioned that I hadn't seen many people with her condition, but I would be willing to see if our working together would be of help. Perhaps we all learning together. We agreed then, and we went ahead. But I think your mention about do we take on or not, and feeling so moved by her return, while also daunted by dementia, which I was not so accustomed to clinically. So that was important. And that was sort of how we agreed to proceed.
Now, I would mention, again, picturing myself in your shoes, at the same time as I would be hesitant and intimidated, I also located myself a fantasy of, well, maybe if we really do some good, uncovering, useful, connected work, maybe we can really change the course of this illness. That is, rather than being intimidated, I sort of get a bit presumptuous and grandiose about, gee, maybe we can, quote, cure Alzheimer's. Don't take that too literally as a fantasy, but it's sort of there. What do you think? Was that something that floated through your mind?
I think I'm not quite as courageous as you in that initially, but I did soon. I was doing some reading, especially in the British literature, and coming across the notion that early maternal child neglect, or as it were, a poor bonding, might predispose someone to Alzheimer's because of the poor internalized relationship. And I did wonder whether our pursuing and maybe making a sturdier bond could help to foster her internal sturdiness. So in that way, I guess I was wondering about what the work could do.
Well, on that topic, let me read what you then wrote, which elaborates what you just said. You wrote, "Whenever we face significant loss, we often feel it initially as a dull, heavy feeling, only later to become more describable as somatic and psychic pain. This dark cloud of unarticulated fear may highlight the value of Sally's trust. Feeling my or another's quiet presence helps to clarify her emotions, because even as she experiences unbearable pain, the cloud appears to lift to some degree. One reason for this seems to be that she does not feel so isolated and alone. Patient accompaniment, amidst trust, seems to make almost anything more bearable. This may be a very important realization regarding this illness." And you go on to say, "These difficult-to-bear emotions significantly contribute to both the sufferer's and caregiver's withdrawal and possible abandonment of emotional connection. The impaired individual may withdraw from true engagement with self and other when the dread of loss, helplessness, and isolation is feared to be too unbearable. As well, caregivers may protectively turn away in the face of similar emotions of loss and helplessness. I wonder whether these disengagements, meant, of course, to avoid pain, might actually contribute to the process of cognitive and emotional decline." Now, I read your book, and I made notes, and I had underlined the paragraphs that I just read. And that was before I knew that your treatment with her those many years before was interrupted. That you in the book, in fact, referred to your abandoning her. You left the analysis after some years to do your training in London. And it had a special poignancy, if not reverberations, when you're now writing about sufferers and caregivers' withdrawal and possible abandonment of emotional connection. When you and I had spoken about this before this moment, and what's your take on all that?
Well, it was interesting to me, humbling to realize that when she first called back, I had forgotten. I did not have in mind that I had abandoned her. That did not come up until we were in casual conversation a couple of months into the work. But I think another thing, I think I felt daunted by dementia, and such that I sort of eclipsed. I didn't remember. And I did have significant guilt, the guilt of abandonment, when I did realize and foster that in. But in looking over the nature of the work, it still was something that I frequently lost sight of in the early part of the work, that I had abandoned her. So that was going to be, not only was she losing parts of her mind, which was sort of where the work, the manifest work seemed to be, but that I had also been a source of abandonment for her. So that was, it was humbling. And talk about learning, as we go. And maybe that was indeed part of the learning, to recognize the source, the various sources of abandonment, what parts were leave-taking, what would return, and then what was lost, never to return.
You know, it is such a common challenge for us clinicians when we are faced with real, objective, outside trauma, facts, input. I'm thinking of COVID. Obviously, we all were facing that. How difficult it is to both honor the realities and at the same time keep one foot in the world of internal life, conflict, and metaphor and transference, which is associated with that. And I can easily see that the pressure of her organic deterioration sort of, and we'll go into this about the countertransference of where you feel sort of merged with your own brain not working in resonance with her. But the other issue that I want to keep an eye on is this interface between psychogenic processes and organic processes. You write, "The most prominent themes in our work together have clustered around Sally's feelings of loneliness and isolation, due in large part to her waning cognition and memory. And yet, when she comments that she has always had trouble making friends, I wonder how much may be due to older issues as well as current ones. Another contributing factor, of course, may be the protective isolation recommended during the COVID pandemic." That is that, just as I mentioned earlier about analysts who, either through psychogenic denial and or through organic deterioration of executive functioning, they are not at their best. But there are these two inputs. I mean, at the beginning of dementia, one does not lose one's internal character. That's still operative. And then there's the organic factor. And how you parse them out is a real challenge. And you give a good example that's coming up. But is that something that you were aware of? Or how did you listen for both, as challenging as that is?
Listen for both. In a way, I didn't separate them off. I thought, I am an analyst. I work with the relationship and as much of the unconscious as I can. We'll find out as the work continues how much, you know, is how much I can help her in terms of conflict resolution, or for me, possibly strengthening a trusting relationship, and how much we will just have to observe as the dementing process. And indeed, that is what we did. So it was interesting, though, that I felt that what I could give, what I could provide, might be the relationship, and as we'll get to in a little bit, facing difficult truths, which really calmed her down, and proved to me that accompaniment, rather than reassurance, that accompaniment to face the difficult truths that were coming, was something that was one of the most profound things for her. And I felt that was a real contribution for her, but also a learning for me.
Before we get to that, one, of course, who needs to honor the countertransference at these moments. And I'm going to ask you to read that on page 7.
Sure. I have felt that genuinely accompanying Sally in her experience of losing parts of her mind involves my opening myself to this inner sense of loss and disorientation as well. Prior to our current work, I could not fully realize this disturbing experience. I had to discover it as, repeatedly following my meetings with her, I seemed to become unsteady in regathering my thinking self. It took me a while to fully realize that this unsteadiness was a sign of my deeply resonating with Sally's memory loss. It often required significant effort for me to regain my capacity to think about the inundating emotions I had been experiencing.
You know, I was really unsettled, I guess, when I read that, in that we are familiar with the experience of being taken over by emotions that seemingly are best understood as deriving from the patient. They can be anger, they can be inadequacy or grandiosity or lust or depression. These things can live in us quite powerfully, obviously, at times. But experience being the best teacher, you get used to that. You get used to, you say, oh, I know what that one is. And you get some, you feel settled about it. This, however, losing one's brain, not losing one's mind, which we may be familiar with, but losing one's brain, losing your memory as part of a countertransference resonance, I would find very disturbing. And is that a fair characterization of what it was like for you?
Yeah, it is. And yet it's interesting. I was helped by some dreams of my own, one of which I put in the book, which is being half submerged in a kayak and there being a colleague named Sally who was with me, and the door was open, and though we were half submerged, we were doing the work. So, you know, isn't it amazing how we can be helped by our dreams? That helped orient me to the submergence, the losing of my mind. So, part of the remarkable journey.
The book then proceeds with your providing us a diary of sorts over the next 3 years in your work with Sally, and it's divided into stages, as is the illness. And this is in the early phase. You write, on several occasions, she has expressed the repetitive conviction that she will be replaced by a younger, more attractive, or competent individual. Early in our work in these instances, my first comment was usually to acknowledge with empathy the pain of her waning capacity. But when she continued being caught up in this conviction of being replaced, I would wonder aloud whether she might currently be plagued by the guilt that she had mentioned when she chose to leave her family home and the care for her declining mother as David, her husband-to-be, came into her life. That she chose a more attractive person in David at that time may have left her feeling that she now deserves to be similarly left for others. This interpretation of intensely felt emotions from the past coming forward into the present would often calm her, and indeed would often bring more forgotten details to the fore. Admittedly, these realizations have generally been soon lost due to Sally's memory issues, but they may remain recallable by her caregivers when such is felt to be useful. Again, thinking of the pull of this organic condition, when I read this and she was saying she was concerned about being replaced by a competent individual, especially by association in relation to David, it occurred to me that the most competent person in her life was you. And that I don't know what threads from your first analytic work together may have been picked up by this, but it could have been her awareness of her waning difficulties and your thriving competencies. I'm not here to second guess how you thought it, but it did strike me that that aspect of your connection wasn't present, certainly not consciously in her mind. What's your sense of it?
You know, looking back in the après coup, how wise we can be, I think you're absolutely right that she was, and that the reason she came back was maybe to pick up some of that, the connection that might be a rescue for her. Early in, and this is part of the first 6 months, that wasn't consciously on my mind, but I think that I was calling, I was using my experience with her, and this was, we were doing conflict work that she could make use of. As things proceed, as we'll get to, that becomes less useful. But I think I sort of implicit memory, the unconscious helps us all, even when we're maybe consciously focused elsewhere.
Sure. And in fact, speaking of her deteriorating condition, you wrote, right, that 6 months later, interpretations which stirred reflection were less useful as her capacity for insight had diminished considerably. And that's when you brought David into the session. And you give us all sort of a masterclass about how one follows the patient's ability. And you write, "My early thoughts, likely due to my psychoanalytic training, were that clarifying feelings was important. But I may have been naive about how the sweep of the negative can plummet her into concrete conviction defined by her doubts and fears. Sadly, it took me several months to more fully realize that accentuating the positive, such as the more distant memories of the decades of her rich life with David, was an important antidote." Now, you write here and throughout the book that as she deteriorated, her fears became her truths. And one doesn't have to have dementia to know what that feels like. I think on bad days, we all know what that's like. And when one is facing illnesses, fears become truths. But again, here, this is a special version of it because it's part of an organic deterioration. But you write, and you write continually through the book about accentuating the positive. Tell us about how you came to that and how you found that useful for her.
I was guided by David, who would say, you know, after your session, she's overwhelmed with dread. So, and that helped me to recognize that she didn't feel a clarification. She couldn't kind of think about and be relieved by my labeling the negative feelings, that she was inundated, rather inundated. So I suppose I was trying to find a balance to register pain and fear in a way which would recognize some of this, but also to appreciate that the waning mind becomes increasingly concrete. There, such as her, she's saying, my fears are my feelings, and that's what's real. And that, so that the concreteness, the negative, which is so much more intense than the positive, could just be overwhelming for her and last beyond our time. So,
now, you involved David in your sessions, and you eventually involved her caretaker in the sessions. Why don't you read on page 31 the notes you took, and this is back from January 2022, so it's really recent, about her feeling unheard. And again, this is an issue, as I reread it again, about where she fits in with David and others. And her sense of herself. Why don't you start us off?
Right, okay. Sally is feeling unheard, saying others take David's views and not hers. Now, I hear this complaint as including me, but also that I'm not hearing, taking her side, but also that Sally may be feeling more isolated as the memory loss deepens. That is, she increasingly cannot hear herself. Now, I gesture an attempt to embrace them both as a unit. This would have been a visual gesture of kind of cupping my hands around the screen. And David providing memory of recent and past events much of the time, aiding Sally's recognition of what she and they have experienced together. As if she has not registered my gesture, Sally wonders how to fit in as she still feels so alone. Trying to listen more closely to her feelings, I agree that she is carrying unbearable pain, shorn by the cruelty of the memory loss issues. She nods and seems less agitated, and I hope that she is feeling more deeply heard, even if only fleetingly.
Did you have a sense when you intervened that she heard your words, essentially, or essentially your voice, and that's what was reaching her?
I would think it's the voice.
You smile when I say that. What was your smile reaction?
I was thinking of the power of the vocal early on, You know, I heard her, I recognized her voice, and maybe she recognizing me.
Right.
The point you also bring up about words becoming less importance, and the sonorous, the sound of the mother's voice, rather, which is all preverbal.
Sure.
And that may be a level, maybe that is very important that you were referring.
Like you pointed out, yeah, the implicit memory. But certainly the words become important when she asks you a direct question, and I'm going to ask you to read that on page 35.
She asks whether her memory issues can get better. And I rather forthrightly say that while we all wish that they might or could, it is not likely. My being open and clear in these comments seems to bring a calm into the room. And perhaps in part, the feeling that we share is that together we are strong enough to face these difficult truths. Then I mentioned that students of Wilfred Bion and others might find here a reminder that when we align with the truth, we may feel a deep sense of being at one with the universe. And when we cannot tolerate the truth, we remain bound by our fears and projections.
I had a reaction to that vignette. Again, I'm doing these child identifications in my mind, picturing me in your shoes, and a dementing patient asking me, as you write, will I get better? And I appreciate what you your approach to it when you said it's not likely. That would be a moment in time for me. And I was interested that you, perhaps for the first time in the book, maybe the only time, you then bring in a reference to Bion. And I wondered, and I shared this with you, this is not a surprise question. I wondered whether, even though you say you rather forthrightly answered it, or maybe because you say what you forthrightly answered it, whether in fact it was a very tender, vulnerable moment for you, one that you turned to a leader, you know, a father's voice giving you support by saying, yes, that was a good thing to do, because it's a very powerful thing to do. Can you flesh out what that was all like for you to answer that question like that?
Many times early on in the work, I felt the wish to reassure her. I realized that I was fleeing the kind of truth that she was asking about. And so I felt, now this is an abandonment by me. So it was with that kind of temptation to flee, which I had, flee from the truth that I had experienced, and as well as the several times when I would broach the truth, and it would calm her down. How painful it is to recognize that. And how worried you are. And so I think that this episode, which is in March of 22, and we had been working 2 full years, that not quite that, a little less than 2 years, that I was more direct about, but it came from my experience of wishing to be other.
Sure. You then brought in to the treatment her caregiver, and I just want to read a reference that seems to address that. You write, the sensory view of David, her husband, paying attention to other individuals or tasks can leave Sally feeling bereft. How easily the more softly held good feelings over time may be swept away. We are seeing that whenever there is a wavering of the sensory experience of being seen and paid attention to, Sally feels rejected. Even when I turn to the calendar for times for future meetings, she feels I'm speaking only to David, not to her. And now addressing the feeling of being dismissed, which used to feel empathic, now only feels entrapping as a truth of David's turning away, the metaphor of the as if you are being dismissed does not hold meaning now, meaning that it is she experiences it as if you are literally dismissing her. And again, we know rejection sensitivity, that exists in non-demented individuals, but it seems clear now that this is an organic process that has taken over her brain. And why don't you then fill us in up to the moment? What has happened to her condition? Where is she now?
Right. Well, we continued to meet until October of 2023. And that meeting included David as a man of action and a man with, they were used to cruising the several of the oceans. David arranged for them to take a cruise from Hawaii to Japan up to Alaska and back to Seattle. And he was trying to rejuvenate her. And because they had loved that cruise previously. But I could see, and they included me because they had significant communication potential to do so, I could see that she was more exhausted. So I could hold that pain.
Now, just to be clear, they didn't include you on the cruise, but it was on Zoom, right? Yeah, right.
That's
okay.
Exactly right. It's Starlink stuff, right?
Okay.
And so I was able to be a kind of fly on the wall, and I could feel the exhaustion for her. But even so, and I think that David was trying to find some respite for himself because he and then Connie, the other caretaker, they were sort of doing it 24/7. So then, but it became apparent upon their return to Seattle in September of 23 that Sally really needed external dementia care, that is, care beyond what the home-based caretakers could offer. And it was quite interesting. Sally seemed to welcome this. She brightened up when she went to visit the external care, the dementia care place. And she had managed to turn away from family, the possibly painful memories about the family, and was welcoming then the new dementia care setting as home. That it seemed to be such a shift in her mood and aliveness that I came to wonder whether possibly in some cases of advanced dementia, there may be a time when the sensory-based world provides an envelope in which the patient more easily resides, maybe not too dissimilar from the sensory-based envelope for the neonate, which greets the beginning of life. Now, Sally remains in that care today, having stabilized, according to David, over the years since admission. I have seen her virtually a few times since. Each time there seems to be a flickering recognition, similar perhaps to that first time on the screen when we met some 3.5 years prior. Admittedly, she is waning physically, as is the usual course of the disease, but she seems to be content, and that is what comforts David as well. That's where things are now.
Right. You had mentioned that, and there is no general mention of her children in the book, except to say at the end that she stopped recognizing her sons. Do I have that correct?
That's right. And she stopped recognizing him, but there was a poignant episode where he couldn't bear to come and visit her because he felt she had receded so massively.
Sure. Yeah. Let me ask you a question. Many, many people have dementia, and there are many, many caretakers for dementia. And analysts are not by any stretch the primary or even generally peripheral caretakers for demented patients. Do you think that being an analyst impacted how you approached your care of her? Do you think it was different? Do you think it was limited because of your analytic training, which you imply somewhere that it took you a while to just be present with her as opposed to interpretive? But I didn't know how you meant that. What? How do you put the two together if you do, your analytic background and your medical background? You're a medical analyst and your care for her.
Well, it's a very interesting question. And I can say just at the outset that I think that my analytic awareness of denial and projection and the concreteness of psychic reality when executive function wanes, that I could help the other caretakers, David and Connie, to understand some of what was going on, because to give them a way to understand that relieved their sense of frustration and uncertainty. And indeed, I think of the analytic awareness of denial, of projection, that these things are not generally recognized by many caretakers, but that it does reorient and make the caretaking function much more tolerable and much more, it expands, I think, the understanding of what goes on in the waning personality. Now, I also think that analytic work fosters the capacity to tolerate ambiguity, uncertainty, pain, and frustration, and in that way may allow us, the analytic mind, to tolerate some of the intense affect that, more as sort of a phrase I love from some Italian analyst, as writings waiting to be completed by the analytic mind that can hold and metabolize the difficulty, so that offer that kind of function rather than unpleasantness just to be rid of. So those are some of the things that I felt are useful as a psychoanalyst.
That's very helpful. Let me turn the question inside out and ask you, has your work with her impacted your work with your regular patients, your non-organic patients?
Yeah. Well, I think it has deepened my appreciation of the potential human experience, especially the waning mind and the concreteness and what it is like to be with a patient, like my submerged kayak experience. As well, I'm very grateful to have been entrusted by Sally and David on this hardest passage, having a deeper appreciation of the power of affects, especially when the constraining capacities of cortical functioning wane. That has deepened my capacity to mourn, that is, to face the pains of difficult truths. But as well, I think I have an abiding curiosity about the world, and maybe it's plural worlds of dementia, whether there indeed is more to discover in that sensory-based world from which we, I'll use the term, the pre-demented, as it were, are excluded. So those are some of the things that are.
That's quite a lesson. If you follow the trajectory from that first call from her, where all of a sudden she emerges in your mind, to what you just said about facing the pain of difficult truths, you two in your, they were obviously separate journeys, but certainly were enriching for both of you, and not just for the two of you, but for those of us who get a chance to read your book and hear what you have to share with us. Maxine, I'm grateful. Thank you for this. It is a new chapter. Maybe that's a little bit too grand. Because I haven't read other material. You have, I should mention, in the back of the book, a very rich bibliography, annotated bibliography of articles on this subject. And they're also in the recommended readings that are attached to the show notes. So there are few people who have preceded you and have worked with these individuals, but it is far from familiar and common. So you've speaking about analysis off the couch, you have certainly broadened our field, and I thank you for it.
A pleasure to be with you, Harvey. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.